Right. Okay, good evening, everyone. Hello. Hello. So tonight is Discovering Buddhism, class 6 of 6 classes. So this is our last class for Bodhicitta. We will break on Monday of next week, since that is Labor Day. And we will pick up after Venerable Robina's visit. She comes June 1st through the 7th. If you are interested, and I highly recommend it, in attending any of Venerable Robina's teachings, please go online and register for those. You do need to register for each individual session, each of the days that she's here. And then we will pick up Samsara and Nirvana on Monday, June 8th for 4 sessions of that. Again, that will be virtually through Zoom or through the live YouTube streaming. For more information about Venerable Robina and any of the other programs that are happening online virtually, just see the website. If you have a completion form for this module, you can email that to me. If you go to that original document that's called About Discovering Buddhism and about this particular module, my email is at the very end of that. It's program.db@kadampa-center.org. Email those to me, and I will forward them on to Don. And I think that's it. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get started.
Okay. Are you going to, you'll type that up, and can, let's see. Is there a, how can, for example, right, we don't have to put this up here now, Linda. Mm-hmm. You know, the meditations for Bodhicitta. Now, there's a chat down here. Uh-oh. Hey. I don't see everybody. I just see one person. Well, I see one lady at the bottom of the screen. Well, do I click on it?
Nope.
Screen share. No?
No, you don't need to click on it.
I don't have to click on anything? Okay. What'd you say, Lily?
No, I just said just
for talking. Alright. Whatever. Hello, everybody. Welcome to number 6. Yay. The last class. It's honestly, we just, the best thing we could have done is would be to do a retreat on this. This is such a piecemeal thing, you know, when you meet once a week and you just kind of, unless people are so, I mean, crazy committed to it, it's tough. This is not the easiest way to learn, but hey, it is what we got. So we're going to start out by, let's see, Linda, are you typing that now? Okay, go ahead and finish typing that. Pardon?
I'm just starting.
Oh, okay, we'll take your time. So here's a cute story. I'm going to start out with a story while Linda's doing the typing something that is a verse from the Guru Puja. And by the way, whenever that ceremony, the Guru Puja prayer is done here, and in the monasteries, you know, throughout the Tibetan Buddhist world, when they get to these standards, they repeat them 3 times. So the one she's typing up now, because they're that important. And it has to do with the practice of Tonglen. So we're talking about, you know, in terms of the kind of, I want to spend more time tonight talking about love and compassion, because that's really what Tonglen is about, and that's the basis for the development of Bodhicitta. But here's a little story out of a book called Bodhicitta that we've used in this class in the past by Venerable Lobsang Gatso. He's deceased now, but he was a great teacher in Dharamsala many years. Anyway, he says, hearers in solitary realizes. In other words, those that are not on the Mahayana path of supreme enlightenment, but more on the individual liberation path. Use logic to see the equality that exists between self and others, and they induce a great compassion by means of that observation. The greater stages of the path quotes the questions of from a famous sutra. So here's the lines. It says, for instance, there's a householder with a single, beautiful, beloved son in whom he can see no fault. One day, the young child is playing and falls into a pit of filth. The mother and friends of the boy see him in the pit. They weep loudly and cry out sorrowfully, but they do not go into the pit to rescue him. Then the father of the boy comes to the place and sees that his only son has fallen into a pit. Alarmed and driven only by the thought of rescuing his son, he descends into the filth without any hesitation and pulls him out. What do these things symbolize? So the filthy pit that his son falls into symbolize the different realms of existence that sentient beings cycle in from lifetime to lifetime. It's just symbolizing suffering and the various ways that it manifests as we're caught up in this cycle of uncontrolled causation, death, rebirth, and suffering over and over again. So that's what the fit of pilt symbolizes. The only son symbolizes us, all sentient beings, all living beings. The mother and the friends symbolize, and this sounds a little harsh, but don't hear it this way. But you know, the path of Buddhism, what we call the individual vehicle, or their motivation is individual liberation, and they have this amazing compassion. Like this mom and particularly the mom and her friends, this mom sees her only son trapped in this pit of filth and is like going to die, and she feels immense. May he be free of suffering. And, you know, she feels that. But that's different than the father. The father symbolizes a bodhisattva. See, this is a distinct feature of the Mahayana. Is that not only do we see the suffering of sentient beings, but, you know, the bodhisattva is willing to do whatever it takes to alleviate their suffering. So this father jumps into the pit, risks his own life, but saves his son from the suffering. So that's the bodhisattva. That's the bodhisattvas are those beings who realize bodhicitta. They realize this altruistic intention to become enlightened. And bodhisattvas, you know, there's two levels of bodhicitta. There's this wishing bodhicitta, and then there's this engaging bodhicitta. And engaging bodhicitta is what this father's doing. He's like, he's not just, you know, thinking, may I become enlightened in order to benefit all sentient beings. He's like taking it to the next step. He's willing to take some sort of action. And that's what, you know, the practice of the six perfections is about, which we mentioned last week and we'll talk very briefly about tonight. But anyway, that's a good example of what a bodhisattva is about. It's like, you know, let's get busy. Let's do what we need, whatever's necessary to stop the suffering of these countless sentient beings. And then, so let's do a little meditation to get started. So sit up straight. You can close your eyes or leave them slightly open. You know, sometimes we usually teach, at least I was taught initially, but I found it distracting in the beginning, but I got used to it after a while, is to leave the eyes just slightly open, just to let a little light in to keep you from getting sleepy, keeps you more, helps you stay more alert. And then you sit up, if you're sitting in a chair, you don't want to be leaning back in the chair. You want your spine straight up like you've got checkers stacked one on the other. Your vertebrae are stacked. And you're sitting straight up. It's almost like there's a hook in at the top of your head, the crown of your head, and there's a rope that goes over a pulley and comes like this, and you kind of pull that rope and your spine gets, alert, erect. And it's that in the mind, honestly, you can experiment with this yourself. When you're lying backwards or leaning backward, or even lying down is even more extreme example, the mind has a tendency to be a little bit foggier. And when your head is slumped forward, not so good. But when we sit up straight, there's a tendency for the mind to be more alert. So this is just part of the posture for meditation is really important. Then, again, I'm sitting in a chair. Some of you may be sitting on the floor. If you're sitting on the floor, either in the half lotus or if you're really flexible and you can do it easily, a full lotus is the most stable position to be in. Then the chin's a little bit tucked in, not up, your head's not up or down, but just your head is neutral, but your chin's a little bit tucked in. Tongue is at the roof of the mouth. Again, the eyes either closed or slightly open. The shoulders are sort of back it down a little bit, so you open up your chest. Again, if you're sitting in a chair, both feet flat on the floor, and then we put in this tradition, the left hand is right hand is on top of the left hand, and the thumbs are touching like this. Okay, and this becomes more important in the tantric practices, but the thumbs are touching at the level of the navel. So you have the thumbs at the navel level and the palms are down in your lap. And your arms are a little bit away from your body to allow a little ventilation. Well, that's good. And now you're sitting like a Buddha, like the statue. And you sit, just being in this posture has a calming effect on the mind. And then we're going to do like we've been doing the last few times where you, as you breathe out, you silently say the word Om, O-M, Om, and then as you breathe in, you count one, breathe out, Om, and breathe in, two. And it's important that you follow your breath through this whole process of exhalation, and then as the breath turns and begins to become an inhalation, your mind is completely aware of that experience, not just the sound of the word Om. And then as you breathe in, you say one, but again, you're following the breath all the way in, and then as it turns and the new exhalation begins, and you say Om, and then turns and as you breathe, breathe in, you say two. So we'll do that. We've been practicing this for the last few weeks. So this is kind of a nice, I think it's a little bit easier for some people to get to 10 this way. If you, again, your contract with yourself is to keep your mind completely undistracted as much as possible, and thoughts and sensations will try to interrupt you, but your contract is to keep your mind on the experience of breathing and saying Om and one, Om and two, and so forth up 10. And if you get lost without being harsh or beat yourself up, which is what our tendency to do is, because we're supposed to know how to do this, but sometimes it's really difficult to even get past number 3. That's pretty good. If you can get to 3 or 4, if you can make it to 10, that's even more amazing. So you do this on your own, and let's settle the mind down. leave behind the distractions of today and any extraneous thoughts that we might be having. And if you get to 10, you start over again. Now relax your concentration. Linda, do we have the A verses? So Linda's going to post the. Oh, good. We'll do this. The A verses of mind training. We can, but we'll do this. This is good. This will be our, basically refuge, bodhicitta, setting our motivation. So we'll read this together. This is that verse out of the Guru Puja that basically is the verse talking about Tonglen practice. So we'll do it three times. And thus, perfect, pure, compassionate gurus, I seek your blessings that all karmic debts, obstacles, and sufferings of mother beings may without exception ripen upon me right now, and that I may give my happiness and virtue to others, and thereby invest all beings in bliss, in order to rescue all beings from the vast seas of existence. I seek your blessings to become adept in bodhicitta through a pure selfish wish, as well as by love and compassion conjoined with the visual technique of mounting giving and taking upon the breath. And thus, perfect, pure, compassionate gurus, I seek your blessings that all karmic debts, obstacles, and sufferings of mother beings may without exception ripen upon me right now, and that I may give my happiness and virtue to others and thereby and best all beings in bliss. In order to rescue all beings from the vast seas of existence, I seek your blessings to become adept in bodhicitta through a pure, selfless wish, as well as by love and compassion conjoined with the visual technique of mounting giving and taking upon the breath. And thus, perfect, pure, compassionate gurus, I seek your blessings that all karmic debts, obstacles, and sufferings of mother beings may without exception ripen upon me right now, and that I may give my happiness and virtue to others, and thereby invest all beings in bliss. In order to rescue all beings from the vast seas of existence, I seek your blessings to become adept in bodhicitta through a pure, selfless wish, as well as by love and compassion conjoined with the visual technique of mounting giving and taking upon the breath. So we'll skip the 8 verses of mind training. So now we're going to do, again, since it's the last class, I wanted to touch on a couple of, maybe go a little bit more in depth on the subjects of love and compassion, because bodhicitta is based on that. But we'll get to that in just a minute. We're going to go through, Linda, can you put up those 11 meditations for cultivating bodhicitta? Still have them? If you don't, it's okay.
I can locate them in a moment.
Uh-oh. Am I messing up my Zoom here? No. It's okay if you don't. It's on the board here. I mean, I can, I think you can see it if you look hard. And I can, oh, there we go. Great, thank you. So, so we're just going to do, we'll go top to bottom, just touching on these points briefly. So again, sit up straight and, as I mentioned last time, I think, this equanimity meditation that I don't know if you can see the cursor there, but the first one, you know, I personally find that one really, really helpful, particularly if there's somebody I'm having problems with. But I've gotten, you know, feedback from other people that this meditation particularly has been helpful. And this sounds a little ridiculous, but you could spend years if you're meditating on bodhicitta. The way to do it, by the way, is if you want to do this as a daily practice, would be, for example, to maybe day one, you maybe spend, you do refuge in bodhicitta, set the motivation for the practice, and then you go through the meditation on equanimity, and you might spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes on that meditation, and then until you get a feeling, some experience, which we would call a feeling of equanimity, this equal regard for the friend, the stranger, and the enemy. And when you get that feeling, you know, we in Tibetan Buddhist meditation, particularly when we're doing analytical meditation, we alternate between doing the analysis, and then when we cultivate that feeling, we stop the mental, you know, the dialogue. The contemplative part of it stops. And when we get that feeling that we would call equanimity, if we had to give it a name, If it could speak, it would say equanimity, okay, equal regard for all beings. When we have that feeling, we hold on to that without any discursive thought, okay? And just hold on to it, that experience. And that takes that meditation and literally it brings it into the heart and at a much deeper level. Before it was in our head, but now it's coming down, becoming part of who we are. It's literally changing our mind into gaining a little bit of that realization of equanimity as we hold on to it. Then if we lose the experience of equanimity, we might go back, do a little bit of analysis, the friend, the stranger, and the enemy, go back and get the experience of that equanimous experience, the feeling that goes with that, and then you hold on to it. And then when it weakens, you go back to the analysis. You might do for maybe 15 minutes a day or longer or shorter, depending on how much time you have. You do that, okay? And that's how we alternate analytical with single-pointed meditation when we're doing these different contemplations, okay? So then you might quickly go through the other points, like remembering, seeing all sentient beings as mother, and remembering that you're mother of this lifetime and so on. You go through each of these other points, maybe giving them a minute or so, just touching on them. Then tomorrow, you do equanimity meditation, take a minute. But maybe seeing all sentient beings as mother, you might take 10 or 15 minutes on that. And then you would touch on each of the other points again, the other 11 points. In any case, you go through each day you give more time to the next point. And for example, if there was any of these other meditations that you want to give more time to, it would be Tong Lin. If you want to give, that's the most important meditation in all of Buddhism. So of course, if you want to give more time to that, you can, but if you're going to try to develop, generate bodhicitta, you go about it in that way. So each day, you focus a little bit more time and energy on each of these points, but always covering all the 11 points, all these 11 meditations, okay? So we'll start out by sitting up straight. And we'll give more time to the equanimity meditation and to the Tong Lin meditation tonight, right now. But start out by bringing your awareness to your breath again. And to your body. Notice that your body's sitting. Be aware that your body's sitting. Be aware of your breath. And we think about the tremendous benefits, so always important to bring to mind the benefits of whatever practice you're doing, and the benefits of developing bodhicitta are unbelievable. I mean, it's an antidote to all of our problems. It's an antidote to the self-cherishing mind. When we develop bodhicitta, when we have that realization in our heart and mind, then we become a bodhisattva. And bodhisattvas are the sons of a Buddha. We call them the sons of the Buddhas. And we're on our way to becoming fully enlightened when we become a bodhisattva. So bodhicitta is so important. It's so important. It's so, you know, the three principles of the path. The first is we call renunciation, which is really having compassion for ourselves, you know, where we recognize that we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation and we make this determination to be free. That's called renunciation, this determination to be free of suffering. That's really having compassion for ourselves. Bodhicitta is having this attitude of universal compassion for all, unbiased compassion for all sentient beings, all living beings. Okay? And then the third of these three principles is the realization of emptiness, sometimes called ultimate bodhicitta. So there's a conventional bodhicitta which we're working on developing tonight, and then when the class on emptiness rolls around, that's called also called ultimate bodhicitta. So important, so very important to cultivate this awakening mind. And the first of the contemplations is equanimity. And as I said earlier, it's easy to have compassion for the people we love, but that's not what we aspire to. And as Mahayana practitioners, we aspire to have compassion for universal living beings. So it's a special kind of compassion that's experienced by Bodhisattva, that excludes no one. So again, it's helpful to imagine that maybe to the left is somebody that we label a friend because they've been kind to us in some way, right? And so they usually, people that are kind to us, we call them friends, and we usually feel a sense of attachment to our friends. We're biased toward our friends in a positive way. Then the so-called strangers, we feel indifference toward most strangers. We don't feel close, we don't feel distant, they're there, They're just there. And then the so-called enemy, imagine to our right, the stranger you can imagine is like somebody in line at the grocery store in front of us, or in an elevator, or it may drive in the car in front of us, somebody we don't know, which makes up the vast majority of beings, right? And then over to the right, we imagine the so-called enemy, or, you might go, well, I don't have an enemy. Maybe it's somebody that you feel resistance toward, aversion toward. It might just be because of how they look. You may have no personal, they may have said nothing to you that aggravated you, but it's better if you can find somebody that you have issues with, because that's where you can actually change that relationship by doing this meditation. So we start out with focusing on the friend, and we notice that all three of these are merely created labels from our mind. There's definitely data out there. There are beings out there, okay? But our mind labels these different beings as friend, enemy, and stranger. There's no inherently existent out there, independent of my mind labeling them friend, stranger, or enemy. It totally depends on my mind and the process of labeling. And these labels are ephemeral. They can change at any moment. The friend, the so-called friend, the person we're attached to, how many friends have we had that have gone to the other side? Now enemies. Or at least somebody that we feel aversion toward, or maybe just resistance to, not happy to see them. Friends can easily become enemies. Friends, after a few years of not seeing them, maybe we have friends, we remember how you graduated from high school and you threw your hat up in the air and you had like 300 people in your class, and now you might only know about 3 or 4 of them. They're all, the other, 296 of them are now strangers. Used to be friends, now they're strangers. So, can easily change. It's just a label. But we get so vested in our labels. And then the so-called enemy, the person we feel aversion to, again, just a label. They said something to offend me, Now, and we think about it. What is this I that labels friend, enemy, and stranger? This I that gets offended so easily. It's a projection of ignorance. It's this false sense of I. The ignorance, we do exist, obviously. You know, there's a combination of a mind and body. We call them the aggregates. The aggregates of mind and body. And upon that we label self or I. And that's what truly, that's who we are. Okay? But then ignorance projects a false sense of I that's much bigger and more reified than who we really are. And it's called self-grasping ignorance. We cling to the sense of a false sense of I, and we believe that that's who we are. And so anybody who's kind to us or says a nice thing, we you know, this false I sees them as a friend and feels attachment to them. I gotta have them. I want to be around them as much as I can, right? And by the same token, the enemy, if somebody says something that offends us, or we don't like the way they look, or we don't like the way they talk, or we don't like their political philosophy, or whatever it is, you know, so then we label them an enemy. Okay? They offended me. Well, look at the me that they offended. That self doesn't even exist. That self is a production of ignorance. But we have believed in that false sense of life from the beginning, a beginningless time until now, and it's gotten us nothing but trouble. Caused all the suffering. Okay? And then the so-called strangers, again, the self feels totally disconnected, doesn't realize that these strangers are just like we are. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer in past lifetimes. When they've been like family to us, you know, they've been so kind to us, but we have no memory of that, no wish to desire to repay that kindness. We feel total indifference toward the strangers. And then if we want to go a little cut deeper, we can look at the so-called enemy, and we try to remember, what he or she did that got under your skin and caused you to hate them, or label, or feel aversion toward them, or at least resistance. What did they do? What did they say? What actually happened? Maybe it was a spouse or a girlfriend or a boyfriend who cheated on you. That's kind of a more extreme example. Or somebody who maybe even killed or harmed somebody that you love or cared about. And they got the label enemy, and I hate you. Right? Okay? Well, that label, enemy, that person, whatever they did, you know, to me, whatever they did to me that seemingly did to me that caused the label enemy to arise in the mind is the product of what? Shantideva again uses the example of if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get angry with the stick. That's stupid. You have to get angry at the person who's wielding the stick. And this, in the example here, the real source of this so-called enemy is our own self-cherishing mind that created non-virtuous actions of body, speech, or mind, or combination. You know, the self-cherishing I planted the karmic seed that is now ripening in, you know, we harmed this person in the past, either in this life or some former lifetime. We don't remember, or maybe we do. But here it is, what goes around comes around. Now, this person is harming us. And we want to blame it on them. But the real enemy lies in the middle of our heart. It's our self-cherishing I that created the karmic seed in the first place. And furthermore, who teaches us patience? It's not our friends over here, because they're just saying what we want to hear. It's the people that push our buttons that teach us patience. It's the ability to tolerate adversity, to be able to deal with problematic situations and people. We don't learn patience and dependence upon friends. We learn it and it's independence upon challenging people and situations. And without patience, patience is one of the Bodhisattva perfections, those six perfections. Without the perfection of patience, there are no Bodhisattvas. There are no Buddhas. Without, so in a way, this so-called enemy is our ticket to enlightenment. We need these kinds of people in our lives to help us see where our practice is weak and to strengthen our practice of developing tolerance and patience. And furthermore, when they harm us, whatever they did to harm us, whatever they did to create, you know, to cause this mind to arise of, I hate you, that's the fruition of a karma. That karmic seed is now played itself out. It's purified. And so in a way, they're helping us purify negative karma by us experiencing the suffering that they're doling out to us. So by using these kinds of, they might seem a little perverse, but these kinds of reasonings can change the way we, the label enemy, realizing that they want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. They've been like family. They've been my mother in past lifetimes. They teach me patience. They're my ticket to enlightenment. You know, they're not the real source of the suffering that I thought they gave. The real source of it is my selfishness and my self-cherishing sense of I. And so we use those kinds of reasonings to change gradually the label of, you know, this feeling of aversion begins to weaken. And we might, and if you feel this for this person, you can stop. We can stop for like a minute right now. If you feel like, okay, maybe not, maybe it is just a label. Maybe this person isn't all bad. You know, just you have more of this sense of equal regard for this person. Not so solid, not such a solid, real, reified enemy or person you dislike, but just kind of a sense of equanimity, this equanimous feeling. So if you've been able to generate that, just allow that mind to settle in your heart. And if you lose that feeling, you can go back to the analysis again, right? You can go back, see them, try to remember what they did. Even allow that feeling to arise of, you know, I really dislike you, whatever it is. Allow that to arise. And then use this kind of reasoning. You know, past lifetimes has been my mother, been extremely kind to me. I must repay their kindness. You know, this is... they're not the cause of the harm that I experienced. They're just the vehicle by which my negative karma came back to me and helped me purify that karma, helped me develop patient endurance, helped me, you know, create the causes for full enlightenment. To go back to that reasoning, that we get the feeling arises again, and we stay with that feeling. So we go alternate the analysis, the contemplation with placement meditation on the feeling of feeling kind of neutral or equal regard for that being that we used to label as and pretty much see as all negative. Now we have some regard for them. Being just, they're just like us. It's just a label. It could change. Just a few kind words, that person could become a friend again, or a friend for the first time. These are not fixed labels. Now you focus on the strangers, you know, which is like the faceless people in the crowd. You can do this, you can practice this, and when you're in standing at the grocery store in line or at the post office or wherever you work or wherever you are, you imagine these faceless people, which we're imagining universal living beings all in human form, even insects. We imagine all these sentient beings in human form, and they're all strangers, and we feel indifference toward them. We don't have any particular feeling one way or the other, and yet they're just like us. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. In past lifetimes, they've been extremely kind to us, as kind as our own mother. And we have an obligation to repay their kindness. And so they're not just faceless people in the crowd. We actually have some connection with these people in very profound ways. And then the so-called friend, they're friends. Why? Because they were kind to us. They respected us. They treated us with respect. They said kind things. They've been there for us and through thick and thin, maybe, whatever the situation may be. But these are, you know, we feel attachment toward these beings, you know, and there's a spiritual love that we could feel toward friends that's not alloyed with attachment. But normally our friends, we feel attached to them. And so, you know, sometimes they annoy us because they do things we don't expect them to do. But we're attached to our friends. And that causes us to create a lot of negative karma sometimes on their behalf. And our friends usually don't point out our flaws, you know. They don't say, hey, you know, you shouldn't be talking like that, or point out areas where we need to work on ourselves. Sometimes, you know, people that have really special, really good friends, the really good friends will take a stand and support us to clean up our act and point out areas where we need to work on ourselves. But most of our friends don't do that. Most of our friends are the friends of our self-cherishing I, our worst enemy. Our selfish, self-cherishing I. That's who they're the friend of. They love that. They are the friend of that. They're the friend of our worst enemy. Is the friend of our worst enemy? I've heard this kind of reasoning before. It's kind of funny. Is the friend of our worst enemy really our friend? Think about that. Our worst enemy is self-cherishing. Our friends, that's who they relate to us as our ego. So is the friend of our ego really our friend? And look at all the problems that attachment causes us to create, you know, attachment to our friend can cause all kinds of issues. And then we say something really rude. Next thing you know, boom, they become like enemies. And they hate us, and we hate them. Just a label. We put so much emphasis on the label, and it's ephemeral. It can change in us. Just like that can change. Just like that. So we need to see that these are impermanent, and we will lose everything. Everything that we're attached to now will be taken away from us at the time of our death, if not before. These are all temporary labels, friend, stranger, and enemy. They will not last. None of these beings will last, and these labels will disappear with the people, with these beings. So, try to develop, again, this equanimous attitude, which is the foundation for universal compassion, because we're not getting, you know, as somebody on the Mahayana path, we're not getting enlightened just for our friends. We want to get enlightened and support all universal living beings to get enlightened. including the people that we now label as enemies, and the beings that we label as being strangers. So we have universal living beings, okay? We have to develop this strong foundation of equanimity. So using this kind of analysis, just for a few minutes, just for a minute, we'll do a single-pointed meditation on whatever experience you feel in your heart that we would call equanimity. And now the next step in the next meditation that we'll do is seeing all sentient beings as mother. Again, if you have issues with your mother, this might not work for you. But if you have a great relationship with your mom, or you have a lot of appreciation for the fact that she brought you into the world and gave you a chance to play the game of life, and we'll get into the kindness of the mother in a moment, but we want to see all sentient beings as mother. because for most people, that's really the most, selfless love that we'll ever experience. Well, we might have the same relationship with our father, but generally speaking, even in the animal kingdom, the dads take off, and the moms are left to look after the babies. And the moms, will even sacrifice their lives for their babies sometimes. So we're going to stick with the mom. So the mom of this life has been our mom in countless previous lifetimes. And now we're imagining we're surrounded by universal living beings, all in human form. You can imagine your mom on your left, your dad on your right if you want. But you see your mom and you say, oh, she was my mom in this life, but she was my mom in countless former lifetimes. Because there's no beginning to time. The beginning of beginning was time. There's always a moment before the last. That there's a moment, and there was a moment that preceded that moment, and that preceded that moment. Consciousness is the same way. It goes back to infinity. There was no beginning to the lives we've taken. There's no beginning to the number of times we've been reborn. And in each lifetime we had a mother, and this mother was our mother in previous lifetimes, and will be our mother again in future lifetimes. And our father has been our mother in previous lifetimes and will again be our mother and father in future lifetimes. And then we look at the so-called friends. Maybe we imagine that we're surrounded by our friends. Maybe they're behind us and we think, oh yeah, so-and-so, that my good friend, my best friend, so-and-so, they've been my mother in past lifetimes and will be again in future lifetimes. All my friends have been. And then the people that we, are indifference toward, which are the vast majority of these universal beings, we think, oh, they've been my mother in past lifetimes, countless times, and will be again in future lifetimes. Again, this is the hardest meditation of all these 11 meditations we're going to do. This one's the most difficult for us to even get a feeling for, but if we can, very helpful. very helpful for the mind to feel connected. And then the so we have, you know, then we go, so we got, you know, universal living beings, and even the beings that we imagine as, you know, we feel aversion toward, again, has been our mothers in past lifetimes, countless times, and it will be again in future lifetimes. So again, for just a moment, we see all sentient beings, you know, we label them as mother. Like Lama Yeshe used to call everybody dear, you know, and you know, or kind, you know, kind mother sentient beings. Sometimes would say that, these kind mother sentient beings. But would he just call everybody dear? That was shorthand for kind mother sentient beings. And you could walk down the street and try this if you want to. Calling everybody mentally dear. See how you react to them differently. Do that now for just a second. Seeing universal living beings, friends, enemies, strangers, everybody as having been family, having been our mother. And label them that way as mother. Dear, whatever works for you. And said that if we do this meditation well, and again, it could take years to even get this, even an inkling of this experience, but the meditators that do it well automatically feel connected to everybody and every living being, instinctively. They just feel some sense of connection. And the next meditation is remembering the kindness of the mother. Not only when she was, again, if you had a good relationship with your mom, it's, you know, you can go back and think of the, you know, the 9 months of gestation while you were in her tummy and all the sacrifices that she made in terms of putting her life, her maybe even her career on hold and not sleeping and maybe throwing up day and night for 3 months, you know, while she had to deal with morning sickness and so on. And then in the last 3 months of the pregnancy, couldn't get comfortable because she weighed, you know, she was carrying around an extra 25 or 30 pounds that wasn't normally there, couldn't get comfortable in bed and couldn't sleep and had heartburn. She had a big bottle of Tums next to the bed because she's caught the good, because you were pushing up on her stomach and all of the acid was coming right up into the back of her throat and she couldn't get comfortable. She made enormous sacrifices for you just to bring you into the world. Then when you were, you know, she went into labor, she had you the old fashioned way, you know, when you were born vaginally, that was very painful. Could have been very painful. Nowadays we have ways to circumvent that with C-sections and epidurals, but still had to bring, you know, had to go through a lot to bring you into the world. And then changed your diaper and got up in the middle of the night and fed you from her own body, breast milk, and did that for as long as she could, as long as she, it worked for her. She fed you from her body and then maybe from a bottle, whatever it took, she did to keep you alive. Without your mom, without somebody looking after you, would not have survived infancy. And usually it's the mom. She taught you how to walk and talk, how to dress yourself, how to clean yourself, took you to school for the, you know, from nursery school all the way, you know, first time you went off to school, she probably felt very sad and you know, because my baby's leaving me, and because she'd gotten so attached to having you around. And then all the way up through high school and college, and you got married and whatever you did, every victory you experienced was her victory. She rejoiced. And every time you felt sad or had some problems in your life, she felt a sense of that, like she felt sad. She felt so connected, like you were like one with her, connected to her, in this almost like a Siamese twin. It was just this connection. And most parents today will say, you know, I never am not thinking about my kids. They're never completely out of my mind. If they have problems, it disturbs me. And when they have, you know, great things happen to them, I spontaneously rejoice. Okay? So that's the kindness of the mother. And we remember, we try to develop a feeling of appreciation and love for your mom of this life, you know, and in past lives when she was she could have given up her life, even in this life. Some moms die in childbirth. But even in the animal kingdom, you can see where moms will die fighting to save their young from becoming some other animal's meal. So moms are willing to sacrifice everything for their babies. So when we feel that sense of love for a mom, we extrapolate that to universal living beings who are all in human form and surrounding us. So do this for just a minute. Try to, whatever feeling of love that you feel toward your mom, imagine that. Imagine all of these other universal living beings who've been your mom, and project that feeling of love toward them. And then there's a spontaneous wish to repay the kindness, which comes after that. That's the next meditation. The wish to repay the kindness of all of your kind mother's sentient beings. And that generates love and compassion, because we realize they're suffering. That's all part of, you know, comes on the heels of this wish to repay their kindness. But the next meditation that we're going to do is the equality of self and others. Seeing that, remembering that everyone wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. So this is something that, our friends, strangers, and enemies, we're just alike. We're all exactly alike. We sit in a room full of people. Maybe you know them, maybe you don't, but you know something very important and intimate about each one of these people. Everybody you meet, you can hang your hat on this, that they don't want to suffer. Even that, right down to the tiniest little insect. To the biggest animal in the world. But others, particularly other human beings, they do not want to suffer. And they want to be happy. So universal living beings are just like we are, equally wanting to be happy and equally not wanting to suffer. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. That's what we say. And then others, which seems like singular, right? But this really infinite, want the same thing. And they all want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Whose happiness is more important? The self that we're thinking about when we say, I want to be happy, doesn't even exist. It's a false sense of self. It's this self-grasping ignorance that's thinking, I want to be happy and I don't want to suffer. But the valid sense of self, the valid self also deserves to have happiness and not suffer, and wants that. That's a valid wish that we all have. Just as others validly want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And we're all equal in this way. 100% equal in this way. So we develop a sense of equanimity. Not equanimity, but equality of self and others. So try to have a feel, generate some feeling for this sense of equality based on this universal wish for happiness and to avoid suffering. And then we get to the faults of self-cherishing, the self-cherishing thought. And we talk about how suffering, all suffering, is the cause, has been caused by this demon of self-cherishing. So we look at all the attend on virtuous actions. And in Buddhism, we think of, like, well, what we all want is happiness, right? So what are the causes of happiness? When we're, you know, as a good Buddhist, we should know that, at the very least. What are the causes of happiness? And the causes of happiness are practicing or avoiding the 10 non-virtues and practicing their opposite. So we're going to go read these. So what are the 10 non-virtues and their opposite? So the first non-virtue we think about, there are three of body, four of speech, and three of mind. So the three of body are killing, and so the opposite of killing is saving lives. So what we need to do is avoid. We say the 10 non-virtuous actions, things to be avoided, because they're not in stone. Because a bodhisattva, this sounds a little crazy, but a bodhisattva has a commitment to break any of these vows if based on pure wisdom and compassion, might have to do something that would look unskillful or look like a broken vow. But in fact, that was what was necessary to do in the moment. So a bodhisattva, and the bodhisattva vows is one of the vows that says you can break any of the other vows if you need to, if that's what's the most skillful thing to do in the moment. But that's a risky one. For most of us who are motivated by self-cherishing, selfishness, so I wouldn't go there. But these are the 10 virtues, the 10 things that we need to avoid. Avoid killing and practice the opposite, which is saving and preserving life. So these are three of body. Avoid taking what's not freely given or stealing. And practice generosity. Avoid sexual misconduct, which is harmful sexual actions, and practice, you know, sexual actions that don't harm others. Practice, you know, that are sort of a manifestation of our cherishing others. And then the four of speech, avoid slanderous, malicious speech, and speak of others' good qualities. Avoid lying and practice speaking truthfully. avoid harsh speech and practice speaking kindly and gently and in a way that's that creates harmony. Avoid idle gossip and practice speaking, having your speech be meaningful. You know, one of the causes of people not listening to us is that we run our mouths all the time. But if we speak when we have something meaningful to say, people listen. So it's very important to practice, guarding the door of our mouth, our speech. And then three of mine are we call greed, or this clingy mind. And then we need to practice letting go, not behaving in a clingy, greedy fashion, but more in an attitude of generosity. And then hatred is another of mine, and the antidote to hatred obviously is love and compassion. We try to develop those kinds of attitudes instead of hatred, goodwill, and love and compassion. And the antidote to ignorance, which is the third of the three mental non-virtues, is wisdom. The ultimate wisdom being, there are many kinds of wisdom in Buddhism, like understanding karma and so forth, sort of faith in rebirth, faith in the three jewels, and particularly faith in your potential to become enlightened. That's the form of ignorance, Buddhism. Believing that you're pathetic, that you don't have this potential to develop yourself fully and eliminate your faults and develop your qualities. Those are all kinds of wisdom, but the ultimate wisdom is the wisdom of emptiness. So we need to cultivate that. We need to give up this sort of ignorant mind, and develop, a wise and perceptive mind that sees things as they are, sees reality as it is, sees ourselves as we really are, as beings that have this Buddha potential. So this is how you find happiness. This is how we find. It's real simple, but it's not easy to practice. It takes great attentiveness and mindfulness. Noticing when we're going down that negative path again, planting the karmic seeds that will absolutely ripen in our suffering in the future. And because karma is expandable, every tiny action of body, speech, and mind plants seeds that are growing exponentially. For example, a tiny karmic seed of they use this as an example in the scriptures anyway, of killing an ant I don't know how long, but at some point, maybe a few weeks or months, the karma is the karma of having killed a human being. This is how karma is. When you think of an acorn, you think in nature you see these little tiny seeds growing in these gigantic trees that weigh tons. You can see how karmic seeds are the same way. Tiny actions of body, speech, and mind that are negative will ripen in future suffering or happiness. So we have to guard the three doors of our mind, our body, our three doors, which are the body, speech, and mind. Okay? So then we see the faults of self-cherishing, our biggest enemy, and the value of cherishing others, our greatest asset and friend. So for happiness, we cherish others. Then we get to the whole, Tonglen has to do with love and compassion, right? It should be Lin Tong, because the way we're practicing it is we're giving others first the first part of the meditation is as we breathe out, we're not going to do the meditation on ourself tonight. We're not going to do the little orb of light that we did before. We're going to sort of use white light going out and black light or smoke coming in like that. We're going to use that visualization, but anyway, the love that we're talking about in Buddhism is the wish that others could have happiness and its causes. Okay? And again, we're not discriminating between friend, stranger, or enemy. It's universal living beings, and we're wishing that all beings could have happiness and its causes. And so there's three different ways that we can do this meditation. And you can start out with your friends. When you get at home, when you're doing this alone, you can start out with your friends and then with your, strangers and then later on with enemies. But you start out with your friends and you think, may you have happiness and its causes. No, start out with this. Wouldn't it be nice if you could have happiness and its causes? Wouldn't it be nice if you could have happiness and its causes? You think about one person. Don't make this about some faceless person. You think about one person in your life right now. You think, wouldn't it be nice if you could have happiness and its causes? And just say that over and over until you get a feeling for it. Wouldn't it be nice if you could have happiness and its causes? And then you go, may you have happiness and its causes. A little bit stronger now. May you have happiness and its causes. Almost like a mantra. We're mentally visualizing this person and wishing them, but in a stronger, using stronger language. May you have happiness in its causes. May you have happiness in its causes. And then you take it a step further, and this is the attitude of the Bodhisattva, by the way. The next one is, I will cause you to have happiness and its causes. I take responsibility for your happiness. I will personally cause you to have happiness and its causes. I will cause you to have happiness and its causes. Now you can do this meditation with a stranger. You could even do it in line when you're like at the grocery store. Look at the person in front of you and go, wouldn't it be nice if he or she could have happiness and its causes? And may they have happiness and its causes. And then I will cause them to have happiness and its causes. And you think, well, this is insanity. I can't even make myself happy. But this is the attitude that we're trying to cultivate. So we practice this. And then we can even go on to the people that we feel aversion toward, right? And we go, wouldn't it be nice if this person that we feel aversion toward could have happiness in its causes? May you have happiness in its causes? And I will cause you to have happiness in its causes. And then we go to suffering. We think, we go back to our friends. And we know that they're suffering. We know that they're caught up in samsara and this cycle of uncontrolled causation, you know, and compassion. They're like three basic kinds of compassion that we are trying to cultivate based on, you know, this. I mean, there's three different ways we think about it. One is compassion, just ordinary, because of ordinary suffering, right? That, you know, sentient beings, we're all caught up in this cycle of samsara, uncontrolled causation, where we're just like magnets. We're going to go through birth, sickness, old age, and death. And we're going to do it again and again and again and again and again. In every life, we're going to have difficulties. We're going to have suffering. We're going to have some happiness too, but we're going to have plenty of suffering, way more than we want in every lifetime. And that's just how it is. So wouldn't it be nice if our friends could be free of suffering and its causes? Another kind of suffering that they're experiencing is that they're qualified, we're all qualified by impermanence. That means that nothing lasts. That they're going to die. Everything that they have, everything that they experience in the moment as a cause of peace and happiness will be taken away from them. Because we are all qualified by impermanence. Nothing lasts. Everything will be literally ripped away from us that we cherish now. Eventually our body, right? Everything will be taken away from us. We're all qualified by that. And that's a source of suffering. We're all aware of it at some level. Some more than others. And then the last cause of compassion to rise is that sentient beings, we all believe in a sense of self. A false sense of self. We believe in it and we cling to it and it becomes like a magnet. It's the biggest problem we have. Is that in Buddhism we say we are empty of, or that's, we are void of, or that self that we believe in and that we cherish so dearly and have caused all of our suffering is a complete fantasy. We're empty of that mistaken sense of self. We do exist, but merely in dependence upon a body and mind. That's the self that exists, not this reified false sense of self. So emptiness, we're qualified by emptiness, but we don't get it. We are drawn into all kinds of problems. Because we believe in this false sense of self. And that causes all the suffering. All the suffering. Self-cherishing I. So our so-called our friend, may they be free. We say, wouldn't it be nice if our friend could be free of suffering and its causes? Wouldn't it be nice if they could be free of suffering and its causes? Again, this is the if part. Wouldn't it be nice if they could be free of suffering and its causes? And here we go. May they be free of suffering and its causes. This is compassion. May they be free of suffering and its causes. May they be free of suffering and its causes. And then I will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. Again, the attitude of the bodhisattva. This true spiritual hero. It's a bodhisattva. I will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. It's my responsibility. And then we can go to the stranger. You know, wouldn't it be nice if these strangers, to make up the vast majority of beings in our world, wouldn't it be nice if they could be free of suffering? But pick one person. Don't make it so impersonal that you can't connect, you can't develop a feeling for it. You know, some person that you have to deal with. May that person, wouldn't it be nice if they could be free of suffering and its causes? And then we got a little stronger. May they be free of suffering and its causes. And then what's even stronger, I will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. For the stranger. Now the enemy. Wouldn't it be nice if our so-called enemy, this person that we have aversion toward right now, wouldn't it be nice if they had if they could be free of suffering and its causes? And may they be free of suffering and its causes. May they be free of suffering and its causes. And I will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. So these are the basic meditations of Tonglen. So we'll start out, we'll just do this for a minute. You'll start out with your friend. And you'll send your friend, you know, white light, which, you know, is basically love. Like, you know, not only may you have happiness and its causes, but I will cause you to have happiness and its causes as you send them this light. Imagine that they're getting what they want and need, which is happiness and its causes. And as you breathe in, you take on their suffering. So do this with the friend, the stranger, and the enemy for just a minute. It's as we breathe out this white light, we're going, wouldn't it be nice if they could be free of suffering? Have happiness in its causes. May they have happiness in its causes. I will cause them to have happiness in its causes. And then they're filled with that white light. And then as you breathe in the suffering of black smoke or black light, you think, wouldn't it be nice if they could be free of suffering in its causes? May they be free of suffering in its causes. I will cause them to be free of suffering in its causes. And as you breathe in that black smoke, it goes right down to your heart and destroys the self-cherishing eye. So that only your valid eye exists now, but your self-cherishing eye has been destroyed by this act of compassion. Again, you give the stranger this white light, symbolizing love, and then you breathe in their suffering, symbolizing compassion. To do that with the stranger and the enemy, the so-called enemy. So it's through this practice of giving happiness, which is what we call love. The definition of love in Buddhism is, may you have happiness in its causes. That's the definition of love. So we're practicing giving love, genuine love, and the definition of compassion is, may you be free of suffering and its causes. And we're practicing actually doing something about it, not just the wish, but we're actually taking on others' suffering. And in the process of doing that, we're destroying our self-cherishing selfishness. So this is Tonglen, this essence of Tonglen practice. And as we did it last week, there's lots of variations on this practice that you can do. It's the most important practice in the Buddha Dharma. You know, I read this many times, you know, in many books, it said this is a practice. This needs to be the heart of our meditation practices, Tonglen, practicing love and compassion, giving love and taking on the suffering, which is compassion. And then we get these meditations that we've done up until now. We have this supreme wish, or this superior intention, which is that I take personal responsibility for giving others happiness and eliminating their suffering. It is my job, again, as we practiced in the earlier meditations, the superior intention, which is a crazy, outlandish, ridiculous, it seems like a madman's attitude, but it is the attitude of all of these holy beings that are bodhisattvas. This is in their heart of hearts. This is how they think. I am personally responsible for your happiness and causing you to have happiness and guiding you to supreme enlightenment. And I'm personally responsible for helping you to eliminate your faults and eliminate your suffering. It's my job. And guiding you to full enlightenment. That's my aspiration. And then bodhicitta is this aspiration, this superior intent. It's beyond this intention. It's this aspiration to achieve full enlightenment. And that's the vehicle by which we can help others. When we eliminate our faults and develop our qualities of compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, and this what's called skillful means, knowing what to do in every situation to help others wake up, to help them stop creating the causes of suffering and create the causes of happiness. Those are the qualities of a Buddha. That's what we need. That's what we aspire to be, and it's based on sincere love and compassion. So I must eliminate the suffering of others and help them find supreme happiness of Buddhahood. Then the method to do that is one's own enlightenment. That's bodhicitta. That's the awakening mind. That's the most powerful attitude we could have for spiritual practice. So if you develop any feeling for that at all, just let that sit for just a minute. You know, we're so fortunate. You know, those of us that come to Kadampa Center, but we're so fortunate because we have, you know, a qualified teacher in Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sampo, people that have spent their whole lives training their mind and are great examples of these teachings. And we've got a perfect situation. We have a life. We have our health. To the degree that we have our health, we have our health. This amazing opportunity to practice the Dharma and to develop as much as we can in this life. We might not make it to full enlightenment, but what else is there to do? We all want to be happy. We want to create those causes and eliminate the causes of suffering. And so that's what the opportunity that Kadapa Center and these teachings offer us. So as much as we can, we want to dedicate the merits, these seeds, because we have planted millions of karmic seeds tonight and over the last 6 weeks. I'm going to say billions. Let's say trillions, whatever. As many as you can imagine. We've been countless karmic seeds have been planted, and to the degree that our motivation's been pure, they will all ripen in future happiness. And particularly, we want to dedicate these karmic seeds to our enlightenment in order to serve others. We want to give them specific direction. So collectively and individually, because we've all done this together. Hadn't been, you know, maybe 15 people have done this class online, plus or minus. But collectively and individually, we've created some energy that we're going to call, you know, and we're going to dedicate all the seeds that we planted to supreme enlightenment in order to benefit others. We're going to dedicate it to others' happiness as much as we can. So I want to thank everyone for your patience with my rambling, and these are, you know, very precious teachings. I feel fortunate to have the opportunity to talk about it, and hopefully some benefit has been gained from your participation in the class. And I want to thank particularly Linda Saw, who's been so helpful. There would be no Bodhicitta discovering Buddhism without her helping make all this happen. So Linda, thank you. And also thank you, because it's in dependence upon students that the teachers show up. Discovering Buddhism teachers, because we all relate interdependently. So thank you for showing up and giving me the opportunity to study and look into these teachings more deeply, because I find it very helpful for me, and I wish you all the best, and I hope that the next class is Samsara and Nirvana, right? Steve, who's like wonderful, is going to teach that. So that'll start in a couple of weeks. So you have a good week. And I challenge you to practice Tonglen in the grocery line and wherever you are this next week. Particularly doing this, wouldn't it be nice if you could have happiness in its causes? May you have happiness in its causes. I'm going to cause you to have it. And do the suffering part. So practice Tonglen this week, wherever you are. And thank you.